free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, May 30th, 2014. And today I want to share with you guys a talk I gave 3 weeks ago today in Utah. I think you guys might like. The organizer asked me to talk about nullification, state nullification, but I snuck some other stuff in there. I talked about how the state pretty much deceives us about everything. It perverts every concept it touches, taxation being contribution, or representation being kind of like the opposite of what we think of representation as being in every other context, or what consent means for you and me is very different from what the state means by consent. As long as you're standing here, you've consented. So it's a lot of fun, I think, this talk. I hope you enjoy it. I gave it for the Libertas Institute in Utah. They're a wonderful organization, very much worth checking out. And you can indeed check them out at libertasutah.org. Before I turn it over to myself, let me remind you, the weekend's coming up. Great opportunity to become a supporting listener of this program. If you're enjoying it, you'll have all weekend long to say, you know what, maybe I should. Doggone it. That guy, you know, he's producing all these transcripts so that I can look at the episode at my leisure. I can give it to my friend who refuses to listen for half an hour. Plus 60% off at libertyclassroom.com and a lot of other goodies. It's like AAA. It pays for itself if you use it right. Supportinglisteners.com is the website. And when you wake up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night tonight, that's because it's the voice of conscience saying, get out of bed, become a supporting listener. All right, here we go with my talk from Utah.
Please help me welcome Tom Woods.
All right, good. I got plenty. All right. Okay. Let's see. All right. Thanks, everybody. Well, we almost had both the speakers who were listed not be able to be here today because of some weird glitch. In my receipt for the airline ticket, it said, departure 2:35 p.m. Central Time. Okay. Then, thank heavens, I got the Orbitz text message reminder saying, okay, your flight's on time, 1:35. And just a look of sheer terror came over my face. Apparently, it had been rescheduled, and I hadn't known about that. So I'm panicking. I'm calculating, all right, well, when would I have to leave? Like now. So, and I have nothing packed. I had to go home. I was at my office. So I zoomed home. I shouted three semi-coherent sentences at my wife, threw some things in a suitcase, and headed over here. So it worked out. I did manage to get here. But so I changed into my suit in the airport bathroom, which I'd gotten at the cleaners. I mean, it was just crazy. So I was still wearing my sneakers, which I had been wearing earlier in the day. So when I got here, Connor took me over to Famous Footwear, and I got myself some dress shoes. I want to say, by the way, that Connor is somebody, as he said, I've worked with quite a bit. He's done an awful lot of tech stuff for me and web stuff for me. And he is so reliable, I couldn't imagine working with anybody else. I email him and say, oh, there's a slight problem. And it's done. Like, I just pressed enter. Like, how could it already be done? He is so unbelievably reliable. I remember there was one problem where my site was down or it was being attacked or whatever. And he was driving somewhere in the snow. And he's saying, well, I'll stop at the side of the road and try and solve your problem. I mean, I don't even want him to do that. You know, he doesn't even have to do that. So anything he's involved with, you can be confident is a quality operation. You can see with the track record of this institute that this guy knows what he's doing, and he runs it. He runs a very tight ship. There's nobody driving around in limousines here. It's just people who really believe in the principles of liberty, fighting and working very long hours. You can be absolutely confident in supporting it. And these days, I just don't have the time to do a lot of pro bono speaking. I have about 600 videos total that I'm preparing for, as Connor mentioned, the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum in various subject areas. So that's kind of a lot of work, you might say. So between that and the fact that we just had our fifth baby, it's hard for me to leave home. Oh, well, thanks. I was pretending that I didn't expect applause when I mentioned the five kids. But I did come here for free because I thought, yeah, I do have a lot going on, and it's really hectic and crazy around my house, but there are a couple people in this world I would do this for, Ron Paul and Connor. And Ron's not here, so... Yeah, 8 weeks ago, we had child number five. They're all girls, by the way. I love saying that, too, because I love the combination of gasping and laughter that I get with that. Like I'm part of some joke that I haven't fully been let in on yet. All right, so Connor has asked me to talk to you tonight a little bit about the subject of state nullification or various things that states can do to assert themselves against the federal government. Now, some of you watch a lot of YouTube, and I've talked an awful lot about nullification on YouTube. In fact, I think a recent statistic found that 8% of all videos on YouTube are me talking about nullification. Now, at some level, it's kind of hard to think of new ways to talk about the same darn thing over and over again. And I know since some of you watch a lot of YouTubes, I don't want to just keep saying the same things, telling the same jokes, so I'm trying to put a new spin on it this time, but this is really it. After today, I'm going to have to start recycling them. So I want to start off, though, by explaining sort of my own personal commitment to this, why it is that I would support this principle of the states being able to protect themselves against overreach by the federal government. Now, there are a lot of people who believe in this because they believe in the U.S. Constitution. And they say the U.S. Constitution clearly delineates the apportionment of powers, the delegation of powers from the states to the federal government. This is made clear. You can see it in Article 1, Section 8, and you can see it in the 10th Amendment. And we want to preserve this balance. And I fully understand and respect that position, and I've argued that position, and I argue it in my book, Nullification. But there's something to me more fundamental than the question of the Constitution. Because whether or not there was a Constitution, we would still favor liberty, the cause of liberty. And my own philosophy is the libertarian view of non-aggression, that you should not commit aggression against other people. You should leave peaceful people alone. It's a very simple thing. It's something you learn when you're a kid. You know, don't punch that other kid. Don't take that other kid's toys. These are the sorts of things we learn as children. And then as we grow into adulthood, we learn all the exceptions to these rules. But as a libertarian, we kind of say, well, wait a minute, you know, my mom was pretty on top of things, and she wasn't telling me there were a whole lot of exceptions to this. Well, if the guy's wearing a special hat, it's okay for him to take the stuff, or he's got an official-looking uniform, well, then there's not much you can do. So my view is just strict non-aggression. And it's my view that government, on the other hand, constantly engages in aggression. In everything it does, I mean, if we're talking about taxation as being legal plunder, as Bastiat said, that's government engaged in aggression. Government, in my view, encourages conflict between groups, because whenever government does something, it inherently favors one group at the expense of others. So it can help one demographic group, one age group at the expense of others, one region at the expense of others, one industry at the expense of others. And it pits us all against each other in a kind of low-intensity civil war. It squanders resources. It makes us poorer. and it perverts every concept it touches. So, for instance, think about the way government thinks of consent. Now, when you and I think of consent, we think that means that in order for a transaction to occur, both parties have to agree to it. So in order for a marriage to be considered valid, for example, you need the free will, the consent of the would-be spouses. You can't have one forcing his view on the other and calling that consent. When we, for example, when we buy a house, we make clear that the buyer wants the house and the seller wants to sell the house to him, and we fill out a lot of forms indicating, I want the house. When you go to buy a car, if you take out a loan to buy a car, you fill out a lot of forms indicating that you are going to make such and such payment every single month and you agree to this. That's how we indicate consent. We normal people indicate consent. But how does the government get the idea that we've consented to what it's doing? Does it send us a form to fill out indicating our consent? Now, you would think that with the government, I mean, we're sending them, I don't know, 30% of our income. And then at different levels, when you add in all the other kinds of taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, the taxes in hotels, the taxes on parking, when you add all that up, it's kind of a lot. And this is a lifelong commitment that we have to the government, even more important than a car loan. And for a car loan, you fill out 27 documents. But yet with the government, I never filled out anything. They never sent me a document because they're afraid I might not sign it. So they say that it's consent anyway. But how could it be? Like, you never even asked me. You never even bothered to ask. They say, well, you know, it's sort of consent because, you know, look, you're still here. That's the argument, by the way. You haven't moved away. So that means you agree to everything. And there are people on the internet, by the way, they think this is a really strong argument. Yeah, man, you haven't moved away. So that proves that you agree to it. So I have to move away now? To prove that I don't agree? Like, when did this moral principle get introduced? Well, you know, I mean, you're still on the playground, so that means you consent to that bully. I mean, what parent says that to his kid? No one. Or what if the mafia moved into your town? Would it really be your moral obligation to move away? Like, wouldn't you say, well, maybe they should move away, right? So the whole thing is a perversion of the idea of consent. Or even the idea of representation takes on a different hue under government influence. In ordinary civil society, we think of the idea of representation. The classic example of representation is an agent. You have an agent. Could be a literary agent, an agent of all kinds. The agent gets instructions from the principal. I say to my agent, here's my manuscript. Go pitch it to these publishers and see what they say. And he does it. He represents me. He does what I ask. He represents me. But what does representation mean in government? Like, for example, I grew up in Massachusetts. I have never been represented in my entire life, is what I felt like when I was living there. Because my so-called representative, every single thing that person did was the exact opposite of what I would do. What kind of sick world are we in which this is called representation? If this were my agent, I would have fired him years ago. How can it be representation when the agent doesn't even know most of the principles? And most of the principles disagree among themselves. The concept of representation is meant to conceal the brute fact that some people rule and others are ruled. Oh, wow. Or how about this one? How about this perversion? Taxes are contributions. I mean, people actually say this, by the way. I think Harry Reid said that not that long ago. I used to think that was a joke that we made up that no one would actually say. But now think of this, though. I mean, sometimes it's worth asking fundamental questions. The old Harvard philosopher Robert Nozick had this interesting allegory, and he called it the tale of the slave. And I'll give you the condensed version. He says, let's imagine that we got a slave, and the slave is ruled over by a terrible, cruel master who whips him and mistreats him and exploits him terribly. We all agree that's morally wrong. Forced labor at the end of a whip, that's morally wrong. Well, let's suppose the master sees the error of his ways and decides not to use the whip, but still forces the guy to be a slave. Well, we still think that's pretty terrible, right? We still don't support that. Well, then suppose he says, well, you know what? I'm going to allow you to take 2 days off. You can have the weekend. Be a slave the other 5 days. We would still say, you know, the principle of the thing is still a problem. You know, it's still there. What if he said, you know what? You can have 4 days off. You have to be a chattel slave only 3 days of the week. What are you complaining about? Only 3 days a week. We would still say, you know, I think you're still not seeing the basic idea of what's wrong here. Now, what if he said, look, I'm not even going to make you work for me. Now I release you into society, but every week you have to send me a check for the equivalent of 3 days of your labor. Oh, now that, a gasp emerges from the room, because that sounds a little bit like what we do. And so what Nozick says after he goes through all the various steps is, when did this stop being the tale of a slave? Interesting. I mean, there's a lot of mind-blowing questions that we're not encouraged to ask. So this is the way I think, anyway. So I look at the federal government and I think, well, this is the opposite of everything I believe in. So how can I keep this thing at bay? What are different ways I can keep this thing at bay? Well, I can try to alert my fellow citizens, hey, there's a moral problem here. But there are other ways too. And one way that Jefferson believed in and others was that if political power exists, you break it up into little units. You break it up into little bits. Jefferson was not some Enlightenment optimist who thought that human beings could be trusted with political power. It was precisely because he feared they couldn't be trusted with it that he wanted it broken up into bits, that he didn't believe that checks and balances, like we learned in the third grade, was enough to keep government limited. I mean, why would it? Checks and balances between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, there's no reason that would keep government limited. It might keep some abuses from occurring. But as Jefferson warned in 1825, what do we do when all three branches gang up on the public? Well, I wonder what he would think about what's going on in the year 2014. So I favor having the little bits have as much power to resist the large bit as possible. And in fact, this is how liberty emerged in Western civilization that we belong to. Liberty did not emerge in Western civilization because there was a Europe-wide government, because there was a European Union in the 15th century. Throughout most of the history of Europe, after the fall of Rome, we don't see large empires taking its place. In fact, the short-lived empire of Charlemagne, even that was not nearly as far-flung as the Roman Empire. What you had was large-scale decentralization, hundreds and hundreds of small principalities. And if any one of them became too oppressive, it was very easy to exit because there's another one 5 feet away. And so each one knows it can get away with exploiting the public only to a limit because the people can easily get out. When you have one giant jurisdiction, on the other hand, when you have the exact opposite of this and you have a world government and it becomes oppressive, where can you escape to? Mars? Like, where are you going to go? So when the right of exit becomes more and more difficult to exercise, then the political class will begin to increase the exploitation of the public. So this is why it should not surprise us that liberty developed in Western civilization under these circumstances, because there were incentives for these predatory forces to remain limited. Also, name me one dictator who ever said, I think power should be broken up and returned to the towns and cities. Ain't no such thing. So you know you're on the right track when every dictator who ever lived is dead set against your principle. In fact, I have a funny little part in my book Nullification, where I say, you know, we had this American politician who said, we've got to move against states' rights and obliterate them completely. The idea should be that there's one approach for the whole nation, regardless of state boundaries. And then I say, oops, sorry, that wasn't an American politician. That was Adolf Hitler in his book Mein Kampf, which perhaps you haven't read, but he does have a states' rights section in there, and he's against it. Now, people say, Woods, that's kind of a cheap shot, bringing up Hitler. You know, because now there's this rule, because you know how on the internet you have a discussion with somebody for 5 minutes, and before you know it, he brings up Hitler against you. And so now the pendulum has swung in the other direction. Now it's considered out of bounds to bring up Hitler. No, it's not. He did say that, so I'm going to mention it. I'm not letting Hitler off the hook. I'm anti-Hitler. Yeah, there's some courage here. All right. Now, it's difficult to favor political decentralization in the United States because the very idea is toxic in the minds of most Americans because of what we're taught by in our history classes. What we think we know about history strongly influences how we think about issues today. So, for example, the kind of shtick that I have when I'm talking about government in general, I say we all got in junior high school, we all got this sort of version of society. We were all told that before government reached the size that it is today, well, life was terrible, right? People worked in terrible conditions, and children had to work, and everybody worked 100 hours a week for 3 cents an hour, and everybody was eating poison food, and we lived to be 8 years old, and there was no art anywhere because there was no government to support it, and there was no science. And so in the absence of government science funding, everybody worshipped Thor. Now, I understand there is a superficial plausibility to this because it is true that in the old days, people worked in terrible conditions and were very poor and all that. But the reason for that is not that there was a lack of government. I mean, I talk about this in my book, Rollback. The reason for that is the society was extremely poor and the economy was very primitive. So, of course, they're going to be in those conditions. It's not the government that got them out of that. It's the fact that now we can produce more stuff. And the greater abundance of stuff makes our purchasing power go up, and that improves our standard of living. But that's not what I'm talking about today. I'm going to talk about the version of history that tells us that centralization in particular has been a good thing. That people who favor decentralization favor the oppression of people. And people who favor centralized power, these are progressives who are just dispassionately committed to the common good. Now, I don't think that's really true or a complete story, certainly of the American case of centralization. I'm going to give you some examples, but certainly in world history, I think if I looked hard enough, I could pick out some examples of centralized regimes that were not very good to minorities. Like, I myself am half Armenian. The Ottoman Empire was a pretty big territory, and they did not treat the Armenians very well. By some estimates, 1.5 million of them were killed. So much for the idea that decentralized power is what minorities need to be afraid of. Or what about the Ukrainians living in the Soviet Union? 5 to 6 million of them were starved to death on purpose in the early 1930s. I mean, enforcing a policy that starves Ukrainians to death when they have some of the most fertile soil in the world, I mean, that is evil of a diabolically clever nature, that you could actually enforce a terror famine in Ukraine, which they did, to wipe out Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian resistance. I mean, there are more obvious examples. I could mention Hitler again, but I think I've reached my quota. But we can think of many African countries that drove their Asian populations out because they resented the success of the Asian groups. Whatever it is, there are countless examples of oppression by centralized states. We can think of examples of this even in our own country. But we're also taught that smaller states or small-scale decision-making is backward and primitive, and surely we're too sophisticated for that today. But again, when we survey the history of Western civilization, we don't find that large-scale states are necessary for human flourishing or the cultivation of human excellence. All we need to do is cast our gaze upon Renaissance Florence, tiny Renaissance Florence, for example. Or classical Athens, which we might compare to present-day Rhode Island. Classical Athens inspired, well, the Carolingian Renaissance, the Renaissance of the 12th century, the Renaissance also, the Enlightenment, it inspires people today, the philosophy, the art, the architecture, the innovations in a wide variety of fields, Greek drama, etc., is still being studied today. And they were, what, just a small, I mean, if you think in terms of how many of those people were citizens, it might be 40,000. Switzerland has maintained its independence in Europe for 700 years. The city-state of Venice flourished for 1,200 years. Ah, but large states are necessary for safety and security, we're told. Is that so? Well, think about the 20th century and ask yourself, was Germany a safe place to live in the 20th century? Considered particularly in the first half? How about the Soviet Union? Would you want to live there? Nice and safe? Would you feel safe in the Soviet Union? How about China? China under Mao Zedong, would you feel safe there? Was Great Britain a safe place to be in the 20th century? How about France? So there are a lot of different ways to think about size and scale. And maybe the best, most humane way to live is not for one city to make infallible decisions for 310 million people. You know, when you put it that way, you think, gee, that is sort of at least, at the very least, a debatable point. And yet, if you so much as raise it, there's something wrong with you, maybe you have a psychological disorder. Why won't you stick to the debating points that the New York Times has graciously allowed us to talk about? You know what they say? If you ask the wrong questions, if they get you to ask the wrong questions, it doesn't matter what your answers are. And, you know, there are a lot of people on the left who claim to believe in the old phrase, small is beautiful. Right? Small is beautiful. E.F. Schumacher talked about that. Small is beautiful. We want small-scale things. We want small-scale agriculture. Small-scale this and that. But yet the same people who say small-scale this, small-scale that, think it's perfectly within scale for 310 million people to have their decisions made by one city. What? But that's a gigantic, absurd, inhuman scale. In fact, I remember years ago, back in 1996, I was at the E.F. Schumacher Society Decentralist Conference. This is a decentralist conference. Decentralizing. And everybody was so excited that they had gotten a special message from Al Gore, who rules over a huge, unitary, gigantic behemoth. No one saw a contradiction there. Hello? I know, but on the other hand, on the neoconservative right, sometimes we can be just as impatient, and we have good reason to be just as impatient, because I talk to Tea Party groups a lot. A lot of these are just decent Americans who are trying to do their best in trying circumstances. But a lot of these folks, they believe in American exceptionalism, that America is the greatest country in the world, and America is special. It's not like the other countries in the world. And yet, when you talk to some of them about the states and nullification and standing up to the federal government, they'll say this is treason. The United States is a single whole. So in other words, the United States is the best country in the world. It's different from every other country. However, we should organize it exactly like all the other countries in the world. So this is kind of a low blow, but I will sometimes say, to try to ease them into thinking my way, I'll say, look, the world is full of centralized states where there's one power center dictating to everybody in society. The world is lousy with those, right? We got it in France, we got it in Britain, we got it everywhere. Everywhere you look, that's the way society is organized. The United States is supposed to be different. I mean, do we really want it to be like France? And they go, and it's like that word echoes in their heads, France, France, France. Oh, no, no. And I think, got him. Low blow. Don't accidentally do anything French if you're a Tea Party person. It's the worst thing. So that gets them. But again, when we break out of this artificial box that limits the way ways we're supposed to think, we could ask ourselves this question. Is liberty more likely to be preserved in a bunch of little jurisdictions or in one great big jurisdiction? Think of the incentives that are involved. Well, I want to turn now to Utah. Before I get into the more general principle, I want to explain the occasion for my talking about this at all, and that is my own personal interest in what's been going on in Utah with regard to the NSA. Now, this bill that was drafted and that in some ways was inspired by the 10th Amendment Center is very, very interesting and very important. Because as I'll mention in a few moments, the abolitionists, the anti-slavery crusaders, did everything they could at the state level to thwart the federal government. They wouldn't let the federal government use local jails to confine runaway slaves. There were cases earlier in U.S. history, which I'll also get to, where, for example, Jefferson is imposing an embargo, and in Connecticut, they're impeaching any state official that cooperates with it. So this is not anything new, what was being proposed in Utah. It's new. It's news to a lot of people because we don't read this in history books. And so I want to suggest this Utah bill is exactly like what the abolitionists were doing. It's saying that, you know, we ourselves can't shut the NSA down, but boy, we can throw a lot of roadblocks in the way. So first of all, no, that's good. Yeah, right. Darn right. So first of all, the aspect of this that got the most attention is the turning off of the water, because they need 1.7 million gallons of water a day to cool the computers. Oh my gosh, what are they up to? 1.7 million. So now that got a lot of attention. There's the website offnow.org with the details. But there are other provisions, too, in what was originally proposed. There's a suggestion that, okay, even if you do manage to gather this data, and there are a number of these bills in other states, too, we're declaring right now that any evidence thus gathered will be inadmissible as evidence in any court in this state. That's another way to say, or if you're a university, if you're a university that's cooperating with the NSA, watch what happens to your budget next year. Ooh. That's the only way to get a professor's attention. That is the only way. Now, what's beautiful about this is that this and some of the other provisions in the bill, in large part, this is the brainchild of a friend of mine who started the 10th Amendment Center, a guy named Michael Bolden, out in California. And I had him on my show not long ago. I have a podcast. Let me tell you about this right now. I have a podcast that I do Monday through Friday at tomwoodsradio.com, and I want to suggest that you subscribe to it. You can, if you go to tomwoodsradio.com, you can subscribe on iTunes and get all the shows. I've got like 150 episodes. You never have to listen to anyone again because I got so many to keep you busy. But in particular, I think for people in Utah, you'll enjoy the show because Utah is just one state out of 50, so it's 2% of the states. But in terms of the percentage of guests on my show who have been from Utah, it's 3%. So Utah is vastly disproportionately represented on my show. So I had Michael Bolden on, and I said, now look, Michael, I want you to suspend all modesty. I want you to be completely honest with me. Who came up with the idea of shutting off the water? I just want to know. And he thought of it. He's a guy sitting in his apartment. He started the 10th Amendment Center in 2006. Now notice, in 2006, Barack Obama was not the president. And yet, people, there were still some people who believed in the 10th Amendment even then, if you can believe that. So he started it then. And of course, people now say to him, well, where were you when Bush was doing... He said, well, I was running the 10th Amendment Center, as a matter of fact. That's where I was. And the 10th Amendment Center now has got state chapters all over the country. The New York Times and all these major outlets are always asking him for comment. He goes on major media all the time. And it's just run out of his apartment. You know, you get the impression that it's this big thing with a Greek facade with columns, and it's his apartment in Los Angeles. One guy did this. And if you ask me, coming up with something like this is more productive and valuable than everything the Washington, D.C. think tanks have ever done in their entire existence. You look at the budgets of these places, they write up a whole bunch of policy reports that go right into the garbage. That's what they do. They pretend to influence the government, and the government pretends to be influenced. And they write letters saying, please, please, the republic is going to be lost if you don't send us your Social Security check. Well, you know what? Michael Bolden does what he does on a shoestring. And he does it with the active opposition of those think tanks in D.C. If you were naive, you would think, why? They should be supporting him. You haven't been around long enough if you think these unnamed institutions in D.C. would be supporting him. What they're all about is making sure pretty much nothing really changes the status quo. What Michael is proposing here and what's being proposed in Utah, and I wanted to keep coming up in the future, would change things. There's no doubt in my mind, this would be in the history books. This would be in the history, because already the NSA scandal will be in the history books. That we know. But if a state stood up and said, we are thwarting this, that would make history. There's no doubt in my mind. What I like also about Michael Bolden is that he is not at all what you would expect. He's not the stereotype of somebody. You know, he's not the coat and tie sort. I mean, he drinks like kale juice. Like, he does all weird California things, you know. Walks around in sandals all the time. But what's great about that is that when Mother Jones, the Smearathon left-wing magazine, wanted to write a devastating attack on him, they called him up and, oh, they were going to hate him. They found they loved him. They didn't know what to do. So they wrote a puff piece about him. I said, man, I got to learn from that. Be nice. Note to self. Be nice. Wow, it pays. But I would say to the state legislators, now I know the ones in this room are sympathetic with us, and that's wonderful, but I bet this message will be heard by other people too. Do you want to be remembered for something? Because when we're gone, we're not going to be remembered for a whole lot. There are a lot of things that people are going to just forget all about. And if we sit by and just let this status quo continue, well, no one's going to remember you. No one's going to give a single thought to anything you ever did in Utah. But this, if the legislature of Utah approves this and puts whoever happens to be the governor at that time on the spot, this is a history-making moment. This is the kind of moment that gives meaning to people's lives, that gives meaning to why we're here. Okay. Oh, is it real? Because I thought you wanted more, no? Okay, all right, good. Okay. All right. Now here comes the fun. Here comes some fun. Now I want to share with you some episodes from U.S. history to show that we didn't make this stuff up. And yes, the idea, I won't develop the idea here because you can, as I said, there are many, many YouTubes defending and responding to criticisms of the idea of outright nullification of unconstitutional federal laws. What Utah would be doing in this case would not quite be nullification because there isn't any direct way to overturn. I mean, the NSA is going to be there and you can't stop it. But you can obstruct it to the point where you're practically stopping it. And so it's not quite, doesn't quite rise to the level of nullification. But there is ample constitutional argument for this. There are many strong arguments that can be made for it. We can see all through early U.S. history the understanding that what made the United States what it was that not that it was a great big indivisible blob, but that it was a collection of societies. And one of the roles of those individual societies was to keep an eye on the center. And you notice, by the way, in the Constitution, every time the United States is mentioned, it's referred to in the plural. Because that's what the United States are. They're a collection of societies. They're not a single blob. And we see them acting like this. Now, a lot of people already know about what Jefferson and Madison did in 1798 when they resisted the Alien and Sedition Acts. But what a lot of people don't know is what happened in 1809 in New England. Because in 1798 in New England, they were all in favor of the Sedition Act. They were all in favor of criminalizing speech against John Adams. They had no problem with that. And they came right out and said it. They came right out and said, this is wise legislation. Virginia and Kentucky shouldn't be considering nullifying this. This legislation is a long time coming. They said that. I put it in my book. They said that. And yet, you know what? It turns out that actions speak louder than words, because when suddenly the federal government was doing something New England didn't like, well, all of a sudden they're all Jefferson and Madison up there. January 1809, the Massachusetts legislature has had it up to here with the embargo that Jefferson imposed, an embargo on all ships leaving for any foreign port anywhere in the world, as retaliation against the policy on the high seas of Britain and France. The Jefferson policy did not change the posture of Britain and France, but it did attract a lot of opposition. The Massachusetts legislature in 1809 declared the embargo to be, quote, in many respects unjust, oppressive, and unconstitutional, and not legally binding on the citizens of this state. Whoa, wait a minute. Didn't they hear that if you support the states, you probably support slavery or something, right, as we're all told? And then they say, while this state maintains its sovereignty and independence, all the citizens can find protection against outrage and injustice in the strong arm of the state government. Now, by the way, I'm no fan of the state governments either. They might as well do something good for us, right? Protect us from the federal government. Then in Connecticut, Governor Jonathan Trumbull, the next month, said, whenever our national legislature is led to overleap the prescribed bounds of their constitutional powers, on the state legislatures in great emergencies devolves the arduous task. It is their right, it becomes their duty, to interpose their protecting shield between the right and liberty of the people and the assumed power of the general government. The Connecticut legislature responded to this and said, resolved that to preserve the union. Now notice that, isn't that funny? That nullifiers are accused of breaking up the union. They say, no, to preserve the union and support the Constitution of the United States, it becomes the duty of the legislatures of the states in such a crisis of affairs vigilantly to watch over and vigorously to maintain the powers not delegated to the United States but reserved to the states respectively or to the people, and that a due regard to this duty will not permit this assembly to assist or concur in giving effect to the aforesaid unconstitutional act passed to enforce the embargo. Resolved that this assembly highly approve of the conduct of His Excellency the Governor in declining to designate persons to carry into effect by the aid of military power the act of the United States enforcing the embargo, and that his letter addressed to the Secretary for the Department of War containing his refusal to make such designation be recorded in the public records of this state as an example to persons who may hold places of distinguished trust in this free and independent republic. Resolved that the persons holding executive offices under this state are restrained by the duties which they owe this state from affording any official aid or cooperation in the execution of the act aforesaid. Well, that's a pretty gutsy approach. Then in Rhode Island, that it is the duty of this General Assembly, as the organ of their sentiments, the people, and the depository of their authority, to interpose for the purpose of protecting them from the ruinous inflictions of usurped and unconstitutional power. Resolved that the several acts of the Congress of the United States laying an embargo by the permanent interdiction of foreign commerce and by the numerous and vexatious restrictions upon the coasting trade do, in the opinion of this General Assembly, infringe upon the undeniable rights and privileges of the good people of this state. And then, resolved that the act of Congress of the 9th of January last, enforcing the several embargo acts, is in many of its provisions unjust, oppressive, tyrannical, and unconstitutional. Resolved that to preserve the Union and to support the Constitution of the United States, it becomes the duty of this General Assembly, while it is cautious not to infringe upon the Constitution and delegated powers and rights of the general government, to be vigilant in guarding from usurpation and violation those powers and rights which the good people of this state have expressly reserved to themselves and have ever refused to delegate. In Massachusetts, U.S. Senator Timothy Pickering said, "How are the powers reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people, to be maintained except if the respective states, judging for themselves and putting their negative on the usurpations of the general government, accomplish it?" The Massachusetts legislature several years later said, "We spurn the idea that the free, sovereign, and independent state of Massachusetts is reduced to a mere municipal corporation without power to protect its people and to defend them from oppression from whatever quarter it comes. Whenever the national compact is violated and the citizens of this state are oppressed by cruel and unauthorized laws, this legislature is bound to interpose its power and wrest from the oppressor its victim." Now, there are many, many passages like this that one may cite. They are astonishingly clear and precise. But I want to leave you with this one, because it runs so contrary to the official narrative of U.S. history that has been sold to each one of us. And that is the case of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. Now, it's true that Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution has the Fugitive Slave Clause that talks about returning runaway slaves to their masters. However, this does not mean that absolutely any measure whatsoever to accomplish this end would be considered constitutional, and a number of states found that act to be open to constitutional objection. So, for instance, they believed that the lack of a proper jury trial for accused fugitives conflicted with the obligation of the state to protect their citizens against kidnapping, which is what they called it when a federal marshal came in and tried to take these people. Also, bystanders could be forced to assist in the capture of a fugitive, and stiff penalties were imposed for anyone who harbored or tried to obstruct the capture of a fugitive. And then on a more technical note, the Constitution requires judicial officers to be paid by fixed salaries. But the fugitive slave commissioners were paid by fees. And it's interesting to note the nature of those fees. If the commissioner returns a runaway slave to his master, his fee is $10. If he sets the man free, his fee is $5. Well, I mean, there's obviously a certain incentive at work there. So, as I mentioned, in the northern states, they did everything they could to try to obstruct this. And I gave you numerous examples of how they did that. But in the case of Joshua Glover in Wisconsin, we had a case of a man, Joshua Glover, who had been taken into custody by a federal marshal who was trying to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, saying that Glover's a runaway slave. A local anti-slavery newspaper editor named Sherman Booth frantically runs around distributing handbills to people, informing them of what's going on, urging them to assemble in the courthouse square to ensure that the accused fugitive would get a jury trial, would not be removed without one. Finally, time's running short, so Booth just ditches the handbills and just rides his horse throughout Milwaukee's business district, and at street corners he just shouts to people, "A man's liberty is at stake." So a number of speakers address the large crowd that gathers in front of the jail where they were holding Joshua Glover. And Sherman Booth rouses the crowd into action. And after he spoke, the crowd forced its way into the jail and released Joshua Glover, who gets away. So Booth is arrested. He's brought before a federal district court. He applies for a writ of habeas corpus, and a judge of the Wisconsin State Supreme Court orders him released. The state Supreme Court said that the Fugitive Slave Act is unconstitutional and therefore void. So off he goes. Well, the same federal marshal before long arrests him again. This time he's found guilty of violating the Fugitive Slave Act. He's imprisoned and fined. But once again, he was released on order of the state Supreme Court. So finally, the Wisconsin legislature in 1859 says this. It is supporting, in other words, what its state Supreme Court has done. And in supporting it, releases this statement. "Resolved that the government formed by the Constitution of the United States was not the exclusive or final judge of the extent of the powers delegated to it, but that in all of, but that as in all other cases of compact among parties having no common judge, each party has an equal right to judge for itself. So Wisconsin is going to judge for itself. And then it goes on to say that it would be a despotism if the federal government had a monopoly on declaring what its powers were. And then it says that the several states which formed this instrument, being sovereign and independent, have the unquestionable right to judge of its infractions, and that a positive defiance of those sovereignties, of all unauthorized acts done or attempted to be done under color of that instrument, is the rightful remedy. They're quoting word for word from Thomas Jefferson, from the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 and then 1799. The Anti-Slave Catchers Mass Convention issued a handbill that talked about the need to defend our state and our state rights against the federal government that wants to deprive people of these most prized possessions of constitutional liberty. So you see, the truth of the matter is just the opposite. That when nullification was used in a matter pertaining to slavery, it wasn't used to support slavery. It was employed to fight against it. But this is just one of many examples of how what we have been told in history is quite the opposite of what in fact happened. And the most interesting chapters, the most revealing chapters, the most inspiring chapters are distorted or left out. Well, I will leave you with a note of hope. And the note of hope is, remember, one guy thought up this bill, the inspiration and ideas of which are spreading around the country, and he's taken on the entire Pelosi to McCain establishment. Anytime something terrible is going on, you can guarantee that Pelosi and McCain support whatever it is. And both of them love you guys being spied on. They don't like being spied on, but the rest of us, it's okay. We can spread our ideas so easily these days. In the 1990s, under Bill Clinton, people have said, how come you didn't favor nullification under Bill Clinton? That's because you're racist, because Clinton was white and you liked being ruled by him. It's that we didn't have the internet yet. We couldn't get these ideas out because the New York Times doesn't talk about the stuff I told you about today. But with the instruments at our disposal now, we can spread these forbidden ideas. So what if the radio won't talk about it? So what if the newspapers won't talk about it? Newspapers? Who even reads them anymore? Forget it. Well, I'm going to leave you with this here. Two things. One, listen to my show because it's 3% Utahns, even though you're only 2% of the union. Second thing is, everybody here has a niche to fill. Michael Bolden found his niche. If you think, well, I don't know what my niche is. I don't know what I can contribute. Talk to Connor. He'll find something for you. I guarantee you. Don't just go home and say, boy, you know, those were some nice speeches and we had a nice night. Think about what is my unique talent that I can share with this cause? Connor will have some use for it here in Utah, I guarantee you. My niche is doing this sort of thing, writing the books and doing education. And I will leave you with this little offer. This will, in a certain indirect way, refund the money that you spent on the ticket. And that is, I have this website that Connor mentioned. Representative Roberts is a member, so, you know, he's a man of good taste. At the site, instead of my just complaining that the colleges are full of propagandists and the kids are learning rotten economics and rotten history, I'm just teaching it myself at this site with other people I trust, Kevin Gutzman and other reliable people. And we've got courses that you can listen to in your car, the education that we all should have gotten but didn't, and so I had to spend 20 years learning it on my own. We've distilled it into these courses. We got 9 courses right now. We got Q&A forums. We got recommended readings, so you don't have to figure out, is this book reliable or not? It's a great resource. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, it's $99 a year for 9 courses. It's not too bad. But for tonight, for everybody who's here, it's only $25. But how do you get it? You go to libertyclassroom.com, and you use the coupon code. It's got to be in all caps, Utah. I figured you could remember that one. Utah in all caps, like you're shouting Utah, okay, which is what I said when I arrived here. Okay, Utah, right? That's the coupon code, and that's going to be good for 24 hours. So if 2 days from now you say, oh, I forgot to do it, I'll go try it, and it doesn't work, you cannot write to me and say, now, Woods, I'm sorry, a lot of things came up and I didn't have time. I will say to you, you're obviously a raving lunatic. Why would I give a 74% discount? I never did that. Okay, so do it immediately. LibertyClassroom.com, coupon code Utah. And remember this. Forget about waiting for the U.S. Senate to set you free or whatever foundation in D.C. Remember what Lord Byron said. Who would be free themselves must strike the blow. Thank you all very much. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that talk. Unfortunately, the coupon code Utah has expired, but coupon code discount has not, in all caps. LibertyClassroom.com with discount in all caps in the coupon code window, and you are golden. All right, that's it for today, everybody. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.